Good afternoon, and welcome to the U.S. Conference of Mayors Opportunity Zone Conference. My name is Brandon, and I'll be your operator for today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, during which you can dial star 1 if you have a question. Please note this conference is being recorded, and I will now turn it over to Mayor Barnett. You may begin, sir.
Well, thank you, Brandon. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Brian Barnett, Mayor of the City of Rochester Hills, Michigan, and President of the United States Conference of Mayors. I want to thank everyone for making time on a busy afternoon for today's conference call on Opportunity Zones, a topic in an area that's really, really critical to America's mayors and America's cities. I'm proud of the work that the Conference of Mayors has done because we've really been heavily involved in the Opportunity Zones discussion since their inclusion way back in 2017 in the Jobs and Tax Act. And we've met with, on many occasions, both Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina and Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey, who were, of course, folks will recall, the original sponsors of the Opportunity Zone legislation. Since that time, we've also worked closely with the Treasury Department and the White House in the development of some of the regulations. We've met with the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, on several occasions. And have also submitted comments to the IRS during the different phases of the regulatory development as this act has grown and walked its path. Those regulations now have been finalized, and now, as all of you know, sort of the real work begins. So what we decided to do was to have a conference call and really a series of calls to provide those listeners with the introductions to some folks that can really help you get this done, provide some additional support in the area of Opportunity Zones, and to respond to the questions you might have as you look to try to implement this in your own community. So the conference has had a real strong leader, a great friend, and really a fantastic mayor. My buddy, Columbus Mayor Andy Ginther, who chairs our Council on Metro Economies and the New American City, and he's really led our work on Opportunity Zones. And so at this point, after thanking all of you, looking forward to this discussion, I want to turn it over to Mayor Ginther to make some additional comments and then to introduce our presenters this afternoon. So, Mayor Ginther.
Thank you, President Barnett, and thanks to all of you for joining us here today. I want to let you know that this is first in a series of calls that we will be doing on Opportunity Zones, and we'd love to hear from you about ideas for future topics and issues that we could cover in the future. So we're not going to cover it all today, but we have some incredible speakers and looking forward to hearing them. We have three speakers from the Opportunity Fund perspective, investors that are coming to the table looking for projects in Opportunity Zones. At the same time, these investors are particularly interested in social impact investing, projects that will have impact on the zones that we're trying as mayors to revitalize. We realize that all of us on the call have busy schedules, so we'll try to be as efficient as we can. We'll hear from all three investors and then turn it back to Brandon to facilitate questions for the speakers or others on the call. The contact information for each of our presenters can be found on the usmayors.org. Website underneath the Issues tab, then click on Opportunity Zones. And we really would like to hear from you regarding Opportunity Zone topics that you would like us to address in the future. Please contact Dave Gatton at dgatton@usmayors.org for your ideas and suggestions. Here in Columbus, we have a number of exciting things happening in several of our Opportunity Zones. We've gained significant visibility in the Opportunity Zone conversation through our prospectus and fact sheets, reaching out to the businesses and investors, as well as making sure the affected communities understand the program and its effects on their businesses and properties through community-level meetings. Like many of you, one of our biggest priorities here in Columbus is affordable housing. And last year, the voters of Columbus approved a $50 million bond issue to help us start tackling this challenge. We're currently undertaking a regional study on the issue because we believe that we can only solve this regionally, collectively working together. And we've seen significant interest in incorporating affordable housing components into a number of projects that are leveraging Opportunity Zone funds. So in our Milo Grove neighborhood, we leverage city housing property tax abatement, where we leverage to attract, where we're able to attract opportunity zone funds to The Rise, a new residential community. It includes 192 units in 8 three-story buildings, plus a separate clubhouse building. This project integrates public-private partnerships to deliver top-of-market product at an unmatched level of affordability, while also contributing to public art. Gravity 2 is in one of our fastest-growing opportunity zones, Franklinton, Columbus's original neighborhood, and it'll be home to 140,000 square feet of Class A office, 110 market-rate units, 25 for-sale townhomes, and 180 workforce shared living units in addition to new retail space. This project is using the Opportunity Zone program to attract national-level investors to Columbus. And further west of Franklinton, a family-owned small manufacturer, existing manufacturer, is able to expand after a land sale thanks to the Opportunity Zone program. This business is selling its current location and moving to the Hilltop neighborhood in one of our opportunity neighborhoods. Using this fund, the company is able to build a new facility and hire 6 new employees in the area. A City of Columbus Enterprise Zone property tax abatement was leveraged in addition to the deferred capital gains taxes to expand the scope of the project and increase the number of employees to be hired. So we're very excited about the progress and success we're seeing, but also remembering this is just one tool in a toolkit that is going to take collaboration, innovation, and partnership to truly leverage it on behalf of our residents and your residents in your communities. But now to our speakers. We'll first hear from William Lamb, Director of Capital Solutions, the Enterprise Community Investment Incorporated. Will, welcome, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I couldn't agree more with your last point regarding the need for sort of collaborative and open-minded approaches as it relates to execution on these kinds of projects. So thank you for that. And thank you for everybody for joining this call. Enterprise, for those of you who may not know, is a national nonprofit that's been working for over 37 years to support low and moderate income communities, primarily through the development of affordable housing and other community facilities that support economic mobility and economic development in disinvested areas. So over the course of our history, we've invested over $43 billion in low-income communities across the country. We work in all 50 states, and we work through all manner of tax credit finance, including the low-income housing tax credit, the New Market Tax Credit, the Historic Tax Credits, and all of the alphabet soup of tax credits that exist out there are our business. So when opportunity funds were added to that alphabet soup, OZs and OZFs, we jumped in feet first to the business of trying to figure out how to deploy this capital. And I think that my colleagues, certainly from Wood Forest Bank and otherwise, I'm sure Jonathan will likely agree as well. The challenges that exist in deploying this capital remain significant, and we can maybe speak to some of those. But I'm going to try to stay focused on the positive and sort of proactive ways in which this capital can be useful. I just wanted to highlight the fact that it is by no means an easy solution to capital problems and difficult investments. So specifically, Enterprise has an opportunity fund, which is a bit of a misnomer. We have capital gains from investors that we're looking to place into qualified projects that are mission aligned with our organization. So at present, we have we are actively pursuing a pipeline of affordable and workforce housing developments across the country. Our investments, for the most part, have to be CRA eligible, meaning, and Noel will probably speak to this more specifically, but meaning that the projects have to be very explicitly aligned with the community reinvestment needs of the place in which those projects will manifest. And in many cases, that means that in terms of the mix of housing, 51% of the residential units in these developments need to be available to families earning at or below 80% of area median income. I know that's a mouthful of low-income housing speak, but what that means is that we're after and pursuing what we would call workforce housing investments. We're able to also consider mixed-use projects, but we're primarily interested in residential because that's really our bread and butter. We are able to contemplate projects that mix opportunity funds with other tax credits, low-income housing or new market tax credits, and we have closed one of those low-income housing tax credit deal with opportunity funds, but I can say from some bruises that those deals are not easy and require quite a bit of creativity and collaboration, to the mayor's point from earlier. We're geography agnostic for the most part, so if there's a deal out there that that is consistent with our mission and that has a strong capital stack behind it, we would be interested in considering it. And our pipeline sourcing right now is really coming through a number of different channels, including partners nationally, our low-income housing tax credit syndication team, our mortgage company, Bellwether Enterprise, et cetera, et cetera. So we have tentacles stretching around the United States looking for deals, but not to say we're not interested in hearing from anybody on the phone if there are opportunities out there. Finally, I'll close out my remarks here with just a very really meant to be just a courtesy suggestion, if you will, for what local officials can be doing to support their communities in attracting this opportunity fund capital, and that is that the the devil's in the details, honestly, with respect to these deals. The pipeline is everything. The projects themselves are what make an investment feasible or not feasible, not necessarily the zone or the context of the area or neighborhood in which the project may exist. It really comes down to the deal itself. So anything that local officials out there can do to make their projects more visible to the investment investment ecosystem that exists would be useful. I have a number of phone calls, and I'm sure my colleagues do as well, from local partners looking to attract capital. And when I ask for specifics on the projects that they're hoping we would consider, those details may not exist or may be sort of far off in the future. And so it's just an unfortunate reality that we have to underwrite developers and deals. And so anything that we can, any easier way to see those opportunities would be a real benefit to the industry right now, because there's a lot of capital chasing what I perceive as a relatively small universe of feasible investments. And I will pause there. Dave, I assume you'll make sure that our contact information is available, et cetera, after this call.
Thank you. Thank you, Will. And just to remind everyone on the call, we will hold our questions to the end, and then Brandon, our operator, will come on and help us field those questions and get a response to as many of them as we can today. Our next speaker is Noel St. Clair, who's with Impact Investing and the Strategic Initiatives Manager at Wood Forest National Bank. Noel, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for inviting me to share details about our fund with you today. I'm happy to be joined on the call by Sam Spencer, who is CEO and Managing Director of CEI Bolus Capital Management, and Sam will jump in to answer questions at the end. Our fund, the Wood Forest CEI Bolus Opportunity Fund, is a partnership between Wood Forest National Bank and Sam's company, CEI Bolus Capital Management, which is a new joint venture between a CDFI partner and a commercial real estate firm. So when Wood Forest National Bank set out to become involved in Opportunity Zone investing through our CRA program, we really wanted to rely on the track record of community development financial institutions like CEI. CEI Capital Management had years of track record in new market tax credits and a reach not just in urban areas but rural areas as well, which was important to cover our footprint as a bank. And then the Bolus Company has national reach as a commercial real estate firm. So the three entities partnered up to create a $20 million fund. We are investing across 17 states. That is Wood Forest footprint: Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, and Maryland. And where we are not located geographically, we're still having conversations and sharing opportunities with like-minded investors like Will, who you just heard from at Enterprise. Our average investment size is $1 to $3 million. But for projects seeking greater equity, we are partnering with folks like Enterprise and other CDFIs or CRA-motivated banks. And our fund is specifically focused on commercial real estate projects, again, in both urban and rural areas. We know a lot of capital has been flowing to urban areas, but we are sort of agnostic in terms of population size. It does need to be within Wood Forest geography, as we're seeking to make all investments CRA-eligible. So we're really doing a deep dive into the local impact that these investments will make. We've established a social impact advisory board that looks at every single investment that our Wood Forest Internal Investment Committee approves. And that advisory board is made up of leaders in the community development finance space, as well as academics and others. And they have been guiding our work, as well as the Opportunity Zone Impact Reporting Framework. Early on, we decided to adopt this framework that was put out by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the U.S. Impact Investing Alliance, and the Beck Center at Georgetown. Given some of the lack of federal guidance on impact criteria for Opportunity Zone investments, we adopted this framework, which requires us to look into things like community engagement, social equity, transparency, impact reporting. And it encourages us to have conversations with developers that look beyond just the financial ROI to really holistic conversations, which have led to things like understanding one developer had carved out a piece of their capital stack for local crowdfunding to create local wealth building opportunities, or understanding the history of community engagement that the developer and project sponsor have engaged in before seeking investment. So that's been a very helpful guiding effort for us. The investments that we're looking at are affordable housing, mixed income, mixed use projects, commercial developments that create quality jobs or foster revitalization tied to a local redevelopment plan, healthcare access, healthy food access, community facilities. So we're really looking across commercial real estate investments, but digging deeply into the intended impact. An example of one of our investments is the first investment we closed actually was in the Anacostia neighborhood of D.C. It's the St. Elizabeth's campus, which is being redeveloped into a commercial and residential mixed-income, mixed-use site in a neighborhood that had a poverty rate of 31% and double-digit unemployment. This investment will be part of a much larger project with many funding sources, but will ultimately create 252 units of housing, 80% of which are affordable, 20% market rate, and two commercial office buildings with 220,000 rentable square feet, including a healthcare nonprofit creating over 500 jobs and bringing healthcare access to a medically underserved area, as well as healthy food access and opportunities for workforce development for the residents of the affordable housing unit. So, you know, that just gives you a flavor of the types of projects that we are exploring. Our methods for finding projects so far have really been through conversations with other CDFIs, both CEI, Bolus Capital Management, and Wood Forest have relationships with CDFIs throughout the country. We've also been talking to Opportunity Zone conveners, such as Opportunity Virginia, Opportunity Alabama, Invest Atlanta. These groups have been extremely helpful in terms of connecting capital to projects that they deem higher impact in their geographies. And the Bolus Company's network of commercial real estate developers throughout the country has been extremely helpful as well in terms of sourcing deals. That being said, we are still actively looking to deploy capital, and our funds, in order to remain compliant with Opportunity Zone, expire by June. So if there are projects that are investment ready in your cities, we would love to talk to you. Advice for local officials in terms of attracting Opportunity Zone funding. Again, what we have found is that places that have an Opportunity Zone coordinator or some convening body at the local level have been extremely helpful in seeking to connect capital to high-impact projects. There's also some websites such as Opportunity Collaborative where you can post projects, and some cities have shared Opportunity Zone prospectuses with us, which is helpful for us to know what is important locally as we are looking to make sure that any investment out of our fund is tied to a local revitalization plan and really is bringing to fruition a vision that a community has for itself. So with that, I will pass it over. I know we have more speakers that want to share their funds with you, but please don't hesitate to reach out to me or Sam if you'd like to learn more. I know our contact information will be made available afterwards, but my email address is nstclair@woodforest.com.
Thank you, Noelle. Again, we'll be taking questions at the end facilitated by Brandon, our operator, but thank you for your thoughts and great topics you covered. Our final speaker is Jonathan Tower. He's the founder and managing partner of Arcteris. Jonathan was able to join us at our winter meeting, and we wanted to bring him back to expand on some of the issues he addressed in January, especially his work with existing companies and also with geographically based funds. John, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Mayor. Great to be back with you. As the mayor mentioned, Arcteris is a Boston-based firm. We have a 10-year track record of making impact investments in low-income communities nationwide. And thanks to the U.S. Conference of Mayors, we're actually working with quite a few mayors on city-focused, place-based community development programs that are designed to create quality jobs or to enhance public works infrastructure or to bring things like broadband fiber and solar to their cities. So we're grateful for the USCM partnership on Opportunity Zone matters and for the relationships that this organization has established for us. Our Opportunity Zone Fund, which again is Fund 5, seeks to make $500 million of qualified investments in operating businesses, infrastructure, and real estate with a very strong community orientation. Arcteris is, from that pool of capital, Arcteris is also making commitments to cities and states, typically ranging from $25 million to $50 million per city or state, with specific program mandates, whether it's focus on quality jobs, diversity, equity, and inclusion, or community real estate infrastructure. And in our place-based partnerships, there is a there's usually a government or a foundation partner that is providing an anchor guarantee or a first loss capital investment in the partnership, and that's usually equal to 10 to 20% of the total program size, and then we put up the majority of the capital. We've done this with the U.S. Treasury Department for the state of Michigan. We recently launched Arcaris Baltimore in partnership with several of the local foundations. The Rockefeller Foundation and Kresge Foundation did a competitive RFP process about a year and a half ago, and we won an anchor guarantee commitment from Kresge to do community-focused opportunity zone investments and state of Maine program, and just recently Ohio as well. So we're excited to be developing these new types of partnerships with mayors and governors to enhance their objectives. Just to kind of bring it down to earth for a minute here and talk a little bit about some of the types of projects that we're doing. We recently did a substantial operating business investment. Is a company with about $160 million a year in revenue. The company is called Recaro Automotive, and it's a manufacturing company. So they make automotive seats. They sell to Ford Mustangs, and they're in Porsche, and it's a performance type of car seat. It was owned by a publicly traded company that had decided to shut down the U.S. operations and move the jobs overseas. Fortunately, we got into the discussions pretty early, and we were able to buy the company from its corporate parent. And although they sold us the business, they did not sell us the real estate, so we were buying a 200,000-square-foot factory in Metro Detroit, where the company will be headquartered, and we expect to create about 125 jobs before the end of the year. We're at 75 right now. These are all quality living wage jobs, and just given the emphasis on real estate in the opportunity zone marketplace, it's important to know that this can be a tool for investing in private operating businesses as well. And you recognize the positive impact that brings for job creation and living standards. So we are doing that, and in addition to buying the real estate, we're adding some solar generation so that we can reduce the electricity spend of this company. Another example of the types of transactions we're doing, it's really public works infrastructure, and you know, basically, you would think of this as anything that a municipality would typically buy with a muni bond issuance. Could be water, sewer, schools. We're working on a police department. We're working on an early childhood development center. Could be municipal broadband infrastructure, roads, on-ramps, off-ramps, bridges, tunnels. I think you get it. But these are our infrastructure assets where Arcteris is building the asset. We will own it for 10 years and rent it to the municipality for a discounted below market rate. And then at the end of the 10-year period, the municipality has an option to buy that asset back from the fund at a predetermined price. These types of transactions do have a lot of similarities to muni bonds, and the cost of capital is really set up front, so it's competitive with muni debt financing. I think that the key differentiator is that it's not debt. It doesn't take up your municipal bonding capacity. It's technically off your balance sheet. So these are ways for cities that aren't able to borrow more to fund certain infrastructure projects, and also to do certain projects that might not be available for GO or revenue bonds. Early childhood development centers are one example where, if your state constitution doesn't allow borrowing for something before K through 12, you're not going to be able to tap the muni market for that. So these are examples that we think are really attractive. The reason that they work, just in case you were curious, is that all of these assets give depreciation tax benefits to the investor. The public-private partnership allows Arcturus to be able to benefit from the tax depreciation, which, if that asset were held by a municipality, it would have been kind of a wasted benefit because the municipality doesn't need a tax deduction or have any use for it. So our ability to use those ancillary tax benefits, it's additive to our returns, but it also allows us to provide attractive, affordable financing to our city and state partners. So Arcturus is very interested in creating more city-based programs. We're in various stages of discussion with 20-plus mayors and cities right now designing programs where we will do the same types of things. And some of these are really focused on jobs, and some are more focused on broadband or affordable housing. But we want to know what types of projects are important to you and to the communities that you serve, and to understand how we can bring OZ capital to help these issues. My email, it's just jonathan@arcturus.com. Both of those are frequently misspelled, so I'll spell it out in case you want. I'm also on LinkedIn, but jonathan@arcturis.com, and would look forward to having some independent discussions about these topics.
Did we lose you there?
Oh, nope. That I should have said thank you. And yeah, that's really the end of my piece there. I think it's good time to jump into Q&A or whatever you have next on your agenda.
Great. Thanks, Jonathan. Brandon, can you help to take us through the process for asking questions? Brandon, are you with us?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you'd like to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There may be a delay before the first question is announced. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up your handset first before dialing. And once again, if you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And we are standing by for questions. Okay, showing no questions at the moment. Do we want to move on to our next speaker?
This is Dave Gatton at the Conference of Mayors. Jonathan, I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little more on the lease arrangement between the public sector and the private sector, and what the regulations allow you to do and not allow you to do on infrastructure projects.
Sure. So the IRS December regulations were quick to point out that these can't be loans. So this is not an opportunity to sell City Hall and then buy it back in 10 years for a predetermined price. That would be a thinly veiled fixed income instrument. This is really involving either new construction or significant rehab of existing infrastructure assets. So if we built a municipal broadband network,
we would build that. We would own it for 10 years. The city would have an option to purchase that asset back from Arc'teryx for a predetermined price at some point after the 10th year. Wouldn't need to be at 10 years and a day. It's not like a bond that has a specific maturity, but after the 10th year, that option would be exercisable. The purchase price would be known at the outset, and per the regulations, the purchase price would also need to be consistent with fair market value expectations at the time of the investment. You're not going to say, well, we're putting up $1 million police department. We think it's going to be worth $50 million in 10 years. It has to be reasonable at the time that the investment was made. And if the city did not exercise its option to buy back that asset, they would continue paying rent for it under a 25-year lease agreement. So the lease is really the security on the transaction. So the point in doing this is to remove some of the debt liabilities off the balance sheet of the city, to keep its muni bonding capacity available for other projects that may be needed from time to time, and to allow both Arc'teryx and the city to benefit from the depreciation tax benefits that are only useful to a taxpaying entity. So the model works. Now, similar to other public-private partnerships, the city would typically lease this asset through a for-profit subsidiary. That's pretty standard for P3 partnerships. The city or state, in that case, would create a for-profit subsidiary that would be the renter. But beyond that, it's a pretty simple arrangement. And also, we're quick to point out up front that while we know how to do certain things well, Arc'teryx is not a specialist in water filtration technologies or sewer pipes or public works infrastructure construction projects. Typically, the cities that we work with and Arc'teryx too want the cities to really be able to oversee those projects. Which architectural design you want, which construction firms you're comfortable working with. If a light bulb needs to be changed in the third year, it's probably better handled by someone locally as opposed to Arc'teryx. So we really are there as a financing and business partner, and not making executive design decisions or choosing which valet company should be overseeing the parking lot. Those are really the city's business, and we respect their rights.
Okay, thanks, Jonathan.
Sure thing.
We do have a question on the phone from Springfield. We have Jim Langfelder. Please go ahead. Jim Langfelder, your line is open.
Yes, my question's for Noel St. Clair. Regarding the, I think you mentioned opportunity zone conveners or collaboratives. How does that work? Do cities put out an RFP or a request for information? Because I imagine there's several entities that would help in that initiative. What's the best approach to go about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it really depends. There are some states or cities where a nonprofit just sort of emerged to fill this gap that they identified, I'm sure, with some public funding. Some of it is, I think in the case of Avesta Atlanta, it's out of the Economic Development Office. I know we work closely with the City of Baltimore's Opportunity Zone Coordinator, which is an appointed position. And then Rockefeller Foundation recently announced cities where they are supporting an opportunity zone lead. So I think it really depends. But for us, having a point person that could speak to the city's needs, but really understand, to Will's point, exactly what type of detail investors will need in order to see if it's feasible at this point in time, has just been a really helpful go-to for us and has really strengthened our pipeline in those places where that point of contact does exist.
Great. Thank you.
And once again, if you have a question on the phone, please dial star 1. And standing by for anything further. And from Henderson, we have David Vorce. Please go ahead.
Hi, yeah, this is a question for Jonathan. I wanted to just kind of clarify the transaction, how that would look. So the income to the fund, the OZ fund, throughout the lease would be the lease payments, obviously, and the depreciation and the sellback at the end of the 10 or however many years that would be. So that's
right.
Kind of, you have to look at all those things in the contract to see what, you know, the total cost would be and what how your investors are making the return, right?
That's right. And, you know, independent of real estate taxes, which could go either way, and, you know, other maintenance expenses and things like that, if you just look at the pure financial parts of the transaction, generally speaking, the sum of the lease payments and the buyback at the end of the 10 years would get you to cost of capital somewhere in the 4 or 5% range. It could be a point lower, a point higher, depending on other options that someone other than us would be deciding, but we would be we do run these as basically an open spreadsheet. So our job in these discussions is to show all the choices and help the city partner make the right decision for the city.
Awesome. And so this could be done on several different types of projects, I believe. It sounded like you were saying the Wi-Fi as well as parking lots and things like that, as long as it pencils out for both parties, obviously, right? As long as you also own the land.
That's right. And you know, important thing to add to that, we are a good partner to cities in terms of securing other external funding for these types of projects. You know, let's say you were, you know, working with U.S. Department of Agriculture on a rural utility service financing package for a broadband structure, or you were applying for a series of EDA or DOT grants or something like that. All of those are, you know, additive to the project, and you know, we frequently do projects like that. That will layer in different levels of state or federal subsidy, and to the extent that we're successful in securing those together, those are beneficial to the city as well as the fund.
Cool. Thank you very much.
And from Youngstown, we have Mayor Tito Brown. Please go ahead.
Well, good afternoon. This question is just for all the investors. I thought I heard the word once or twice in your presentations. You talked about the social impact. And just wanted to get a little clarification of when you're doing your projects, how much of that are you looking at? You know, what kind of social impact will I have over once I leave or once the project's completed?
Hello? This is Noelle St. Clair. I can jump in to answer first. From our perspective, it is important throughout the course of our work, especially as we are learning about a project. As I mentioned, we have a survey that we give to project sponsors or developers that asks about things like community engagement, transparency, social equity, and this was really part of that framework that was put out by the U.S. Impact Investing Alliance and Federal Reserve Bank of New York and University of Georgetown. I think it's become a best practice for Opportunity Zone investors. So that is important to us, as well as having conversations about intentional exit strategies. This is 10-year money, so it's helpful to have patient capital, but we want to be mindful about what will be the exit strategy and how can that be structured in such a way that it secures those positive community benefits for the long term.
Well, thank you.
And I just, this is Jonathan, I just add to Noelle's comment, you know, it's something that, you know, if you're only looking at it at the front end, it it's kind of missing the point. You know, not every company is as impactful as they could be after several years of working with them. So we do look to achieve improvements on, you know, KPIs that might be specific to the company or the region. But the real question becomes, you know, what happens at the tail end? You know, mayors that we were working with, you know, what are the immediate questions is, okay, now that we're building a municipal broadband network, how do I know you're not going to go sell it to Facebook and they're just going to use it independently and then we don't have broadband service again? And, you know, I would advise mayors to think about requiring two things. I mean, one is a community advisory group that would oversee or advise these types of projects and, you know, be aware of the long-term impact that'll have. And then secondly is something like a right of first refusal, where at the tail end, if you want to keep that project at the community level and that wasn't already baked into the transaction, the community could buy that rather than letting it go into the hands of a third party.
Standing by for any further questions. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, if I could, this is Will Lamb from Enterprise. I just want to add a real quick point to the impact question, and that is that in terms of projects that are seeking opportunity fund capital for affordable housing from our fund, we need partners, development partners that are prepared and comfortable with the notion of deed restricted rent restrictions on those properties to hold the affordability for 10 years. And so that issue I like to put front and center early on, because many developers are not interested in that conversation, but to the extent that any of you have partners in your markets that are, we would be interested in talking to them.
Okay, and it looks like no further questions on the phone at this time.
Thank you very much, Brandon. This is Andy Ginther, and I'll offer a few comments as I wrap up today's call. I really appreciate those that have joined us today and want to respect their time and wrap up this call. But I want to thank everybody for joining us. Again, the contact information for our speakers, if you have additional questions or want to follow up with them, can be found at usmayors.org. Go to the Issues tab and click on Opportunity Zones. Just a reminder, this is the first in a series of calls. Clearly, we didn't cover everything today. There's so much more to talk about. And that's where I want to encourage mayors and that have joined us here and their staffs to share ideas for topics and issues for future calls. You can share those suggestions for our future Opportunity Zone calls by contacting Dave Gatton at dgatton@usmayors.org. I want to thank President Barnett for his leadership and kicking us off today and all of his service to us as conference, and special thank you to Dave Gatton and the incredible staff, U.S. Conference of Mayors. And if there aren't any other comments, we are adjourned.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for joining, and you may now disconnect.